Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the health care they need. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition, a treasured nonprofit in downtown Fresno that serves the LGBTQ community, has announced its closing. It's not the first time that's happened. We talked to community advocates about why and what's next. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Carrie Klein. We also introduce you to a digital collection of street photography. It's helped one artist cope with cancer. And you thought state water politics were complicated? We take a look at how local water systems are managed.
But first, let's turn to this week's news. The Fryant-Kern Canal won't get funding this year from a $400 million bipartisan bill. SB 559, sponsored by Senator Melissa Hurtado of Sanger to repair the canal, has been tabled. It's a major disappointment, says Johnny Amaral of the Fryant Water Authority.
We were hopeful and looking forward to the state becoming a partner in this important project, but we'll have to regroup and see what the other options are moving forward. The canal has to be fixed.
The canal, which delivers water to farms and communities on the east side of the valley, is sinking in some areas due to excessive groundwater pumping.
Dozens of people showed up to the Fresno County Board of Supervisors meeting Tuesday to hear Sheriff Margaret Mims present data on 2018 immigration and customs enforcement activity in the jail. It's mandatory under the Truth Act. Mims said the department did not release any inmates to ICE, but Maricela Sanchez, an organizer with ACLU Northern California, was still critical of the department's practice to publish inmate release dates on its website.
Publishing release dates is a cruel attempt to undermine the California Values Act or SB 54, opening the door to painful due process abuses and racial profiling.
But Mims said release dates have been public record for 10 years.
The Fresno County Farm Bureau's annual crop report was released this week. Agricultural production value hit $7.9 billion in 2018, a record high for the county, thanks to gains in profits from grapes, pistachios, garlic, and tomatoes. Upcoming crop reports from Kern and Tulare will show which county ultimately came out ahead.
The San Joaquin Valley is one step closer to having its own medical school. California Health Sciences University announced its College of Osteopathic Medicine has been pre-accredited as a medical school, which is the highest accreditation status a school can receive until it graduates its first class. The school has already begun accepting applications, and classes are slated to begin next July.
And finally, earlier this week, Kern was one of many counties throughout California and the U.S. to proclaim September as Suicide Prevention Month. Here's Bill Walker, director of Kern Behavioral Health and Recovery Services, speaking during the Board of Supervisors meeting on Tuesday.
Suicide is the second leading cause in our nation for the age of 15 to 34. Number two. Not just here, but in the entire nation.
Statewide, suicides have increased 9% since 1999. But in Kern, they've increased 25%.
Staying in Kern, I'm now going to tell you about one woman who's made suicide prevention her life's focus. We begin this story in an auditorium in Tehachapi.
First of all, I want to thank all of you brave souls who came here tonight.
Ellen Eggert stands at the front in a tie-dyed t-shirt, sweatshirt tied around her waist, her salt and pepper hair loose at her shoulders.
How many in this room? I got to take my shoes off. I'm sorry. My feet are sweating. Do you mind?
More comfortable barefoot, she jumps right in.
How many in this room have known somebody who's died by suicide?
About a dozen people are in the room. Almost every one of them raises their hand. Eggert works with Kern County's Behavioral Health Department as a project supervisor and head of its crisis intervention hotline. Next, she asks, how many of you have considered suicide? One man raises his hand.
Thank you. It takes a lot of courage. And chances are there's more.
Eggert would know. 3 decades ago, she attempted it herself. She partially blames it on undiagnosed bipolar 2 disorder. She thought she was worthless.
My depression told me the day I die, my family will dance. I believed it. And that's what depression does. It's a liar and a thief. And it doesn't have to be a mental health depression. It can be a situational depression. It can be all sorts of things.
On her wrist, she's tattooed the word hope and a semicolon, symbolizing there's more to her story than her attempt. Emotions are high tonight, like from one man who has a tough time believing that guns, like those locked up in his home, are used in more than half of all suicides.
Well, there's no one in that household that can get to that gun.
Well, I'll tell you, sir, I know what you're saying, and I believe what you're saying. Our kids are so much smarter than we are.
Smart enough to find those guns.
I know exactly.
Tonight's presentation is called QPR, or Question, Persuade, Refer, organized by the county, Adventist Health Tehachapi, and the Stallion Springs Police Department. Eggert has run QPR hundreds of times for communities, police departments, and college students.
The beauty of it is it's pretty simple, and it basically pinpoints the question, are you thinking about suicide?
You see warning signs, you ask that question directly. For many, it's the hardest part of QPR to swallow. Won't it embarrass that person or anger them? Will they even give a straight answer? Eggert says you'd be surprised.
People won't come to us and tell us because of stigma and taboo and judgment, but people want to be asked about suicide. And if you do it in a caring, non-judgmental way, the majority of time, they will tell you if they are or if they aren't.
Then you try to persuade them to abandon the attempt, and you refer them to professional help. Studies have shown QPR training increases awareness and reduces stigma around suicide. Eggert doesn't just draw from her own attempt. She also lost two brothers and two cousins to suicide. It's these and other horrific tragedies that led her to work in mental health. And in her free time, she runs a nonprofit for suicide survivors and their families. It hosted the annual Stomp Out Suicide Walk in Bakersfield last Saturday.
I can't bring anybody back, but if I can help one family after their loss or prevent one suicide, then I have found some good out of some tragedy.
And more good is needed. According to an Adventist Health report, the suicide rate in the Tehachapi area is 50% higher than the county's, and it's more than double the state rate. That's why Police Chief Gary Crowell in nearby Stallion Springs held a suicide prevention symposium in July ahead of Eggert's QPR training. He says around 100 people showed up in their tiny community of 2,500.
I do believe that with our small community that generally you're going to be affected in some way or know someone because we are so small.
As the QPR session ends, I catch up with Chris Frost, a Tehachapi pastor. He says he came to the training because he wants to be better prepared when asked about suicide.
I've had tons of Bible college training, seminary training, and still don't feel fully equipped to deal with this. Honestly, we didn't talk about it in school very much.
Tehachapi resident Carolyn Aranda also found the session empowering. She really connected with the idea of compassion and reaching out to people in need. She just wishes more people had come.
I think a lot of people are afraid to come and listen about it in case they find out that they know someone that's going to commit suicide.
Ellen Eggert knows there's stigma around talking about suicide. She's used to small turnouts, and she says she'll come back as many times as it takes. I ask her how she can handle surrounding herself with suicide talk after all that's happened in her family.
I have to compartmentalize. You know, I have to put my grief and my loss over here and then be able to do this. But that's what also gives me my passion to be able to do this.
And the feedback she gets is passionate. That Stomp Out Suicide Walk she hosted last Saturday, over 700 people came, including her family, who flew in from all over the country. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Alice Daniel. LGBTQ community centers serve as safe spaces to access resources, engage with peers, and feel a sense of belonging. According to the organization CenterLink, there are now more than 250 centers operating throughout the United States. But here in the Valley, financial pressure has made it difficult for many to stay open. Moderator Kathleen Schock speaks with Justin Kamamoto, Executive Director of Common Space in Fresno, Brian Poth, Executive Director of The Source in Visalia, and Jamie Bradley, former president of PFLAG's Merced chapter.
Brian, let's go ahead and start with you.
Sure.
You were a successful actor with roles on shows like 6 Feet Under and True Blood and CSI Miami. How did you go from Hollywood to founding and running an LGBTQ plus center in Visalia?
Yeah, it's weird to hear you even say it because it feels so long ago, and it wasn't really. I grew up in Tulare, and I commuted to Los Angeles as a child. I was a child actor first, and I was also on a show called Kids Incorporated, which was like the very beginning of my career as an actor. And my mom and I ended up moving down there for a while to do that show. And then I moved back when the show was canceled for a short time, and they recast the kids, every year or so. But I moved back, and it was right as high school was about to start. And I had kind of essentially grown up in Los Angeles, and I didn't know any of the kids and in Tulare. And coming back to Tulare at that time was very traumatizing because I had grown up sort of like in LA on TV, and I didn't know what like real life was like. But I had a really good high school experience, and I moved to LA, and I went to college there. I went to film school, and I swore I'd never come back because I knew something about myself that, you know, probably other people suspected, but I knew that I was different. You know, I knew that I was gay, and my first like couple weeks in college like confirmed that, you know. And and I thought I'd never end up back here, you know. I ended up having a very successful career in TV, and in 2010 my sister was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, and I spent several years at that time, you know, thinking like, gosh, I wish I could just like move home for a bit and be close to her. And I missed out on a lot, you know, being in LA. I had a great life, a great career, a lot of exciting experiences, but I was missing my family. And in 2014, I decided to move back. And I moved in with my sister, and she got better, and then she got worse, and she passed in 2017. But in that time frame, I started living in Tulare. You know, I went from Los Angeles to Tulare, and I didn't know what to do with my time, and I was still kind of going back and forth to LA, but I met a couple people that had been that had left and come back to the Valley, and we all commiserated, like, what the heck is there to do here? You know, I didn't really feel safe. I felt like I didn't know if I could be out. I didn't know if I could be myself. I was very comfortable living in Los Angeles as an out gay man, even an out gay actor. That was never a problem for me. But the second I moved back home, all of this like childhood trauma and stigma and stuff came back. And I just thought, you know, if I feel like this is a 40-something-year-old gay man, what is it like for kids here? You know, not a lot has changed. There just aren't a lot of spaces for queer folks. And you know, so I just started talking to people and saying, hey, does anyone want like an LGBT center here? Do you know what that would look like? Is there one close by? So I did a little research, and I think I visited the Fresno space when it was open, and we started looking. This small group of us, Nicholas Vargas is the co-founder with myself, we just started looking at spaces. We didn't really know what we were doing. We just started looking at real estate and trying to figure out how we could open something and we didn't know what it would be either. We just wanted a space where people could go, and then we would ask them what they wanted that space to be. And we just got kind of lucky. And I then, you know, just last year I retired from acting. I no longer do that anymore, and I devoted my full time to being executive director of The Source. But I feel like I'm really, really blessed. I feel like I fell into something that's totally, every single terrible thing that has ever happened to me in my life, and all the good things, has informed this where I'm at today.
Jamie, you live in Merced and have been an activist in the queer community there. You know, Brian used the word safe. Can you speak to the need for physical spaces for people in the LGBTQ plus community to feel safe?
Well, that's an interesting thing, and I can commiserate with you because I, too, had returned to the Valley after being away for most of my adult life after leaving high school. And coming back to that coming back to the Valley, you have that sense of, you know, how do I fit in here? And where is it that I can go that I can feel safe? Now, coming from a large city, I came back to Merced from Minneapolis. So Minneapolis, like LA, has a large LGBT community there. And going to various restaurants or clubs or bars, there's that sense of security there because you are among your own, if you will. So coming back to the Valley, it's an eye-opener, you know, because you forget about how things really are truly here. I mean, it's a mixed bag of people. You really have, you know, I don't think the LGBTQ community is any less in regards to percentage of population here in the Valley, other than that there's fewer people in the Valley than in a suburban area. But that said, there's still, you know, there's still that percent of LGBTQ people here in the Valley. So when you think about something that's between, you're in Visalia, correct? Mm-hmm. So when you think about what's in between Bakersfield and Sacramento in the San Joaquin Valley, the whole of the San Joaquin Valley, in which it really extends north of Sacramento. But when you think of the San Joaquin Valley and what's here, you know, we know it's a rural community. There's farming here. That's what we do here in the Valley. I mean, really, pretty much that's what we do here in the Valley. And then what are those people here in the Valley that are LGBTQ? Where do they go? And within Merced, we have such a high concentration of Hispanic persons, which, you know, because of their, you know, their life and how they feel about the LGBT community is very, very different than from what you might think or what I might think, being that I'm white. You know, it's very different dynamics for those folks. So really, when you look at those folks, even just taken away from just that percentage of people, they really need something. Those LGBTQ youth. They really need something.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Justin, I want to bring you into the conversation. And if you're just joining us, you're listening to Valley Edition. Justin, you have really dedicated your life to filling that void here in the Fresno area. And a couple years ago, back in 2017, opened Common Space in downtown Fresno. Tell us about Common Space and where it stands today.
Yeah, so it's been a crazy 11-year journey of advocacy for LGBT plus individuals. I moved here from the Bay Area in 2008, during the time when Proposition 8 rallies were happening all throughout the state. Got connected with a lot of amazing advocates who were just being out and proud. I think that's ultimately what we wanted. And for me, every couple of years, I always kind of just had this feeling of, let's do something more, or we can do more, or we deserve more. All of those different things all came to mind. And we were running a lot of LGBT plus programs out of these random spaces and backs of coffee shops and parks. And there was never a space that we considered ours, especially for young. I think a lot of us work with youth, talking about young people of color, especially queer identifying youth and allies, that they needed spaces. And at the time when we started Common Space, our Fresno Center closed a couple months afterwards. But we opened in downtown Fresno because we saw there was a community that was revitalizing, was trying to bring together neighborhoods, and not just neighborhoods of queer people, but people of all these diverse backgrounds. Because where we started, 5 minutes in any direction that we went, I mean, we were hitting way below poverty lines. We were hitting homeless areas. We needed just community spaces, and Common Space is more dedicated to supporting the work of nonprofits in our Central Valley area. And together we serve a large demographic as young as 7, as old as 77 for community programmings, events, support groups. But it wasn't meant to be just an LGBT space, because we saw that other LGBT spaces in the Fresno area weren't successful in garnering or gathering our community together in one spot, or they only went to certain places, or the fact that some of our youth are just so proud that they'll go anywhere. They didn't need a space. So where it currently stands right now is a year after we moved into our 1,200 square foot space, we expanded with funding into a space that was 7,000 square feet, where we're currently at now on Fulton Street, in an area that people are heavily looking at for revitalization and showing that nonprofits can have a role in this economic development, and the fact that our LGBT plus dollars and a lot of these people who are not part of the conversation or pictures stimulate and make neighborhoods. And ultimately, neighborhoods are what make communities successful. And we just made the announcement a couple weeks ago that in November, we will actually be closing our brick and mortar location to look at what the Valley really needs. And we talked about this before we went live, is there's a need for funding and funding for these projects that we're doing, and people aren't bringing those dollars to the Central Valley. So we're going to create actually a foundation endowment where in the next couple of years, it'll start accruing interest for us to do grant making. And then hopefully this will build on a legacy of what we started at Common Space, that communities really do matter, and that we need to be supporting all parts of our community and all people within it, no matter what you view as anything, and really support. So our endowment will happen and kind of leave our Common Space legacy there.
Brian, how are you doing financially? How is the source doing financially? Has it been a struggle to secure those philanthropic dollars?
So for us, I mean, we got pretty lucky. I mean, I think there was a vacuum in Tulare County, and we got lucky pretty quickly. Our county health department, our HHSA, reached out to us fairly early on. And within maybe like the first year of starting the source, we were doing grant-funded programming. And from there, it just built. I mean, we had partners that would invite us to submit with grants they were submitting for. And those true partners are still partners today. I mean, so within a year, we were funded and still are sort of a third through funding and foundations through grants. And then fundraisers make up another third of our revenue. And then the other third comes from just private donations, you know, a dollar here, $5 there, $200 here. And it's been a pretty sustainable model. Our first year, we were hoping to raise $20,000, and we were able to raise $40,000. And the second year, we were hoping to raise $100,000, and we were able to raise $150,000. And now we're triple the size. We keep overhead really, really low.
That's got to be key.
We're 2.5 staff. We have 2 full-time staff and 1 part-time staff. We're understaffed. I mean, we all do the job of 10 people.
Yeah.
And so unfortunately, like Justin said, that kind of sustainability, you can't sustain that very long. And the funders really are, they sort of skip Tulare County. There's funding in Bakersfield. There's funding in Fresno. But oftentimes, Tulare County and there's a lack of funding in those areas too, but Tulare and Kings really get skipped, and so we have to sort of fight for it, and we have to ask for it. But what we're finding is that there are a lot of foundations that want to fund LGBT work and advocacy,
And now you have the opportunity for them to do that.
Right. But we've been very fortunate.
Jamie, you were involved with a LGBTQ center in Merced County. Talk about the finances with that project.
It was unfortunately very short-lived. We started out, we were talking earlier, with PFLAG Merced, and that's really where the most of the LGBT community in Merced would gather once a month, was within the PFLAG Merced. And then from there, it morphed into a center because one of our members decided that they wanted to try to open a center just like you had there in where you're at. And they opened. They were successful. They were able to get the center open. But unfortunately, because of the obvious, with lack of funding or monies coming into the center, they eventually had to close that center. From there, the group of people stayed together. I mean, they really tried to. And we had a few over the years. Pride at the Park Days at our local park, which is in the center of the city. And those were quite successful. And it always amazed me every time that I'd gone there for one of those Pride events of how many people just would actually show up from Merced area. And it was really quite a large group of people that would come to the park for those days. So saying that on one hand and thinking, wow, okay, look at all these people. Why can't we keep a center open here in Merced? You know, why are all these people are here? And they obviously they like this, you know, and they want to be a part of this. Why can't we keep something going? But unfortunately, lack of money will close us down.
Right. Justin, I'd love to hear you talk about some of the community reaction Common Space received and how that factored into where you stand today and where you're going to go in the future.
Yeah. So for us, we made the decision. We were doing really well on fundraising and providing enough fundraising support to cover an operating cost of $12,000 each month for the space that we're currently in. It's a lot of work, though. We were an all-volunteer staff. We're all really 20-somethings trying to change the face of what systematic change looks like and build a movement. So for us, the reaction that came out was obviously very sad. It's bittersweet in the fact that we know that where are these homeless transitional youth going to go during the day or apply for jobs or spaces to do homework? We have about 20 different nonprofits housed within Common Space in the brick-and-mortar building that we have now. What's the future going to look like for them? Luckily enough, the support has been good enough for everyone to find new homes, and it's paving the way of what we need to do. Fresno definitely is a long ways away from the idea of what Common Space is and the fact that it's really about bringing people together. And by bringing people together, we can have these real, raw, honest conversations, and we're leaving the drama at the door. Common Space started in 2017. Our goal was to make this a 5-year effort for downtown Fresno, and our goal was to expand up to being a 14,000 square foot building. And within that had multiple LGBT center components, but it really lowered the overhead costs, as like Brian was saying, to make sure that rent was stable, numbers did not fluctuate because it was flat rates all year long for all of our tenants that were in our building. But like I mentioned, it's just not the time. And a lot of people are having different ideas about what resources are being needed in the community.
Right. And there's a lot of ways to serve the community. And so it's interesting to hear all of you talk about the different ways in which you are leveraging your resources in order to be there and be supportive and create those safe spaces. Yeah. Thank you all for the work that you do in the community. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Carrie Klein. Right now, roughly a million Californians lack access to safe drinking water. And while a lack of money or local leadership can stand in the way of fixes, so can California's Byzantine water management system. A new article on UC Davis's California Water blog shines a light on just how complicated water governance can be and why it matters. Here to talk about it with me is one of the article's two authors, Kristen Dobbin, currently a UC Davis PhD student.
This blog post is all about the different types of governance structures or organizations that are operating drinking water systems across the state of California. Basically, we have known for a very long time that small drinking water systems struggle the most, and we know a lot of small systems are out of compliance in the state, but we don't have a lot of information about how those small systems are governed or even the large systems in the state. We don't collect data as a state about drinking water governance. And so this blog post and this research effort was really driven by a desire on our part to understand what is the drinking water governance landscape of California, how are these systems organized, who's operating them, and what does that mean for drinking water quality and the human right to water in California.
Okay, so there are roughly 3,000 public water systems here in California, as you said. And as you said, there are lots of different kinds of ownership. Sometimes they're owned by the city, by the county, by a joint powers authority, or by private owners. We don't have time to go through every possible ownership option. But what are some of the key differences in how water systems can be owned here in California? And how does that translate into a different experience for water users?
So kind of the key difference that we do know a fair amount about is whether it's owned privately or publicly. And that for that kind of category, we do collect data as a state. So we have been kind of dealing with that in our analyses for years, whether systems are private or public. And we know that the majority of small systems are private, whereas the majority of large systems are public. But beyond that, there's a lot of diversity in those two categories. And so what we really wanted to do with this project is dive into the details with our kind of a hunch on our part that the details did matter. And so, for example, like kind of how those details could matter is that amongst the publicly owned systems, you could be an incorporated city or you could be an unincorporated community that's being served by an independent special district. And even among those unincorporated communities, those independent special districts, we found 11 different types, and that those different types determine the structure of the governing board, which includes how those directors are elected, how many directors serve, and for how long they serve. And it also, being a publicly owned system, means that you are eligible to access public financing. So a lot of the proposition money that we have passed in water bonds in past years is usually limited to publicly owned systems. So that is a big difference for the privately owned systems, which may be not able to access certain types of funding like their public counterparts. And then similarly for the privately owned systems, you may be an investor-owned utility, in which case you have additional regulations by the California Public Utilities Commission. But if you are a user-owned utility, meaning that it's the residents themselves that are owning the utility and the community water system, those regulations don't apply. So there's kind of these complex layers of regulation, of access to finances, of access to solutions, or sometimes also constraints on their actions that all have to do with these details in the governance structure.
And so that's one reason why some water districts have an easier time getting public funding or state funding for a project, and some water districts don't.
Exactly. So there's a lot of implications for how we address struggling water systems that have to do with their governance type.
Okay, and so if we look at your findings a little bit here in this project, you know, if we start with numbers, the sheer total of water systems is already kind of mind-boggling that we have 3,000 here in California. But you were also looking at not only the ownership of each water system, but also the population each one serves, the average number of violations each one has had in the last couple of years. What are some of the more surprising or important data points that you uncovered?
Yeah, so among the really important things we found is that, the first finding that sticks out is the sheer number of distinct governance types. So we went into this expecting that there was a lot of institutional diversity in our drinking water system of California, but we did not expect to find so many distinct types. So we identified 26 different governance types that drinking water systems are being operated under. And amongst those 26, importantly, there is greater diversity for small systems. So the realm of governance is a lot bigger for the small systems under 10,000 connections or under 500 connections than it is for the really big systems, which tend to be operated by either large private companies or by cities. A second really important finding that we found was that these different structures correspond to kind of different levels of violations. And so one thing we wanted to look at is the number of systems with violations, or is the average of violations per system different between these different types? And we indeed found that there's variation in how the different governance categories perform. In our analysis, cities have an average number of violations per system of only about 1.43 in the last 7 years, whereas, for example, county-operated systems have more than 3 violations per system for that same time period.
That's really interesting. So what does that mean?
What it means is that governance does matter. I think that's the big takeaway from this project and our starting place for future analyses. So now that we have the information of what governance type each system is, we can do a lot more work into figuring out how that governance type is mediating compliance. And so, for example, we have questions about, is it the type of board or the way that directors are elected that is impacting compliance, or perhaps is it access to finance or other access to other solutions in our kind of state water toolbox? So really, we find that governance is playing an important role in differentiating compliance among systems and kind of creating this diverse landscape of drinking water governance in California. And so the next big question is, how is it doing that? And really diving into some of those details that we couldn't before because we quite simply just didn't have the data.
Right. So this all kind of reveals at least some of the reason why it can be so difficult here in California to provide clean drinking water to so many, especially, you know, very underserved, disadvantaged communities.
Right. This project doesn't give us a lot of answers as to kind of how we go about solving it, but provides a lot more information about the disparities in our drinking water system and the struggles of small systems that will hopefully serve as an opportunity or a jumping off point to get to those answers about how we address chronic drinking water disparities in our state.
Very interesting. Well, Kristen, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Kristen Dobbin is a PhD student at UC Davis studying regional water management and drinking water disparities in California. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Alice Daniel. If you're a news junkie, you may have noticed a new online media outlet called the San Joaquin Valley Sun. The editor-in-chief is Alex Tavlian. He used to be a reporter for the Fresno Bee, and then he became an attorney and political consultant. Now, on top of publishing The Sun, he's doing some campaign work for Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer, who's running for mayor. FM89's Laura Satsui spoke with Tavlian and other journalists about the ethics of reporting on politics while also being involved in the political process. Transparency in the newsroom and media literacy are important topics, especially these days, and we think that discussions about how news is covered, both by Valley Public Radio and other outlets, are helpful to audiences who want to make informed decisions about their news consumption.
Alex Tavlian says he started the San Joaquin Valley Sun because he wanted to create a reliable outlet for people to get news.
A lot of times we get bogged down in, well, who was shot or what car accident happened today, instead of, you know, what important decisions are being made about your community. If you don't know anything, you can't solve any problems.
He says his team of three reporters is trying to carve out a niche in areas that are underreported, like small communities, higher education, sports, and of course, politics.
We've had a lot of segmentation in media, and so a lot of people were looking for an avenue for a good conversation about what's happening in the region, both from a media perspective and from a policy perspective. And so our first project has been The Sun.
But Tavlian doesn't just cover the news, he says. He also does some political consulting. Right now, he's working on Police Chief Jerry Dyer's mayoral campaign.
Yeah, there's people who have said that I'm everything from, you know, the mastermind or whatever, which isn't quite the case. I wish that was true. I like the word mastermind, but that's not the case with Chief Dyer. But I am helping out on this campaign.
A disclosure on a story written by Tavlian said that his political consulting firm is providing help with digital advertising. In an earlier interview, Jerry Dyer told Valley Public Radio that Tavlian has helped with his campaign's social media. But is this ethical? When it comes to political involvement, the Society of Professional Journalists says no. Its position? Don't do it. Don't get involved, don't contribute money, don't work in a campaign, don't lobby, and especially don't run for office yourself.
I think it makes life easier for the journalists themselves to avoid these conflicts, but it also helps the user see your reporting as something that isn't going to be impacted by your outside work.
That's Lynn Walsh. She's the Ethics Committee Chair for the Society of Professional Journalists. She believes a reporter with conflicts could still cover something fairly.
But people may not believe that. And so do you want that to overshadow the coverage of this issue? And I would say no. I would say as a news organization, you want to avoid that at all costs, and you should put another reporter on it who doesn't have those strong feelings or who has not supported that organization.
Alex Tavlian says that since working with Dyer's campaign, he has tried to reassign stories. But with a small team, that's not always possible. Plus, he says he has more access as an insider.
So what I've tried to do is shift as much of the responsibility of the mayor's race where possible. There are some things that, you know, a reporter won't have insights on, where I have the experience, I'm going to, you know, be able to publish it. And that's, you know, my ability to do so is kind of a big and important part.
Some would say that role would better suit a columnist who doesn't have to worry about accusations of being biased more than a journalist. And I asked Tavlian that.
I guess that's fair. I guess the columnist role might better fit me. And that's possible. You know, to me, I my label is executive editor because I do edit most of the stuff that comes through our door.
Lynn Walsh, the ethics chair for SPJ, says that if a conflict is unavoidable, disclosures are key.
What we would say is disclose that conflict very clearly and almost immediately. So don't hide it as a footnote at the bottom, but put it at the top of the story, first sentence of your story, anything like that.
And there are disclosures on some of Tavlian's stories. For example, he's done some reporting on Andrew Jans, Dyer's competitor. He's also written about a former employer, Congressman David Valadao, and his successor, TJ Cox. Tavlian used to work for Valadao's campaign and discloses that. He argues his work there gave him insight most journalists would otherwise miss.
I understand what's going on in this race. And in fact, most of the time, I have more information than most of the other individuals out there.
But that's exactly what a conflict of interest is, says Tim Draklis, the Tartarian Journalism Chair at Fresno State. And he says the role of journalists is to act independently of their sources.
Any outlet in America that sees that would immediately take steps to fix that problem. Because the traditional belief is that you want to be unbiased because that's what your readers need.
Tavlian says he welcomes the skepticism and says it's up to his audience to decide. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui.
James Gathright is a designer, writer, and photographer. In 2016, he was diagnosed with renal cell carcinoma, or kidney cancer. Since then, taking pictures has been an integral part of his therapy, helping him cope with the disease and getting him out of the house. And as a result, he has produced a digital book of 100 photos. It's called I Was Born in a Small Town, Street Photography in the Shadow of Cancer. James, welcome to Valley Edition. Let's start with a definition. What is street photography?
Street photography is basically candid photography that is happening in public spaces. There are many different definitions of it, and it's kind of close to documentary photography.
So give us an example of some of the street photography that you've done.
I've worked mostly in downtown Fresno, and like I say in the book, you can circumnavigate that area in less than 2 hours. And you just walk around and you look for interesting people, interesting places, interesting things, people having interactions, experiences, lost in thought, and you capture their everyday moments.
Basically, you're a fly on the wall.
Yeah, you are a fly on the wall. It's hard to be a fly on the wall in a Fresno. I've talked to street photographers from New York, and you know, they say, get lost in the crowd, and I'm like, there's no crowd.
The collection of photos was shot over a 3-year period. During that time, you went through 2 surgeries, loss of employment, and the diagnosis of your wife, Pat, with Parkinson's disease. That's enough to make some people crawl under a rock and hide. But instead, you got your camera out and you started using it in a sort of therapeutic way. Tell us how that worked for you.
It was very good. I'm an extrovert. And so being locked at home and dealing with, you know, the depression and stuff that comes from cancer, I really had to find a way to get out. I love photography. I love art in general. And so I would drop my wife off at her part-time job every morning. From there, I would drive down to downtown. And I had a camera that is really built for street photography. And so I would just start walking around and taking pictures, and you start to get the feel of the place, and it makes you want to go back and back and back.
And you taught yourself using film cameras and then moved over to digital. Tell us about that.
That came before the cancer, that I found myself without employment, and as a designer, I felt I needed to understand photography better. So I decided to start taking pictures. It's an expensive hobby to get into, so I bought old film cameras. And use them, learn to develop the film myself. And so I got a really good self-education the hard way. So that when I finally did move over to digital, it's a much easier thing for me.
And you said you thought you knew photography before you started doing this. And then once you started taking it more seriously, you learned so much. Give us an example of something you learned using the film cameras that you could then translate to digital.
I guess the use of light. Film is much, much, much harder to capture light well and not blow things out or make them too dark. Digital is actually easier. So if you learned how to do this on film, you've gotten very good at it compared to the digital usage. So that was one of the most important things.
And capturing light in Fresno is probably really important because there is so much light.
Yeah, it's a harsh atmosphere, especially during the summer. Photographers believe you should only shoot before 10 a.m. and after 3. Landscape photographers believe you should only shoot when the sun starts going down. In Fresno, that light is harsh and hard on people. And so you have to adapt some techniques that work with that actually use it.
Tell us about the cover photo in your book.
The cover photo is a group of folklorico dancers, and I wish I could tell you where they were from, but I believe they were from one of the high schools. And it was on the day that the parade happened to open Fulton Street downtown. They were just so joyful, and I had on a very wide-angle lens, so I basically stepped pretty much right into them and took that picture so that it could capture the breadth of what they were doing. And to me, it's one of those photos that when you see it, you see all the different dancers. And if you go from face to face to face, you can see how much they're all loving what they're doing.
Mentioning that, let's talk about the privacy issue. I know you can take pictures of people on the street because it's a public place, but how do you approach it from a conscientious perspective?
You just have to be a good person. you have to recognize when somebody is really not happy with you taking their photo. You have to try to catch candid moments without catching totally private moments. I work around the courthouse a lot, and a lot of emotion goes on around the courthouse. And I can see someone from a distance that may look like they're laughing. And as I come closer, I bring up my camera and start to begin to take pictures. And even sometimes till I get home that I realize they were laughing, they were crying. Those photos go away. You know,
wow.
There's one photo in my book that shows a woman sitting in front of the federal courthouse with her hand on her head. And it obviously looks like possibly distressed moment, but I believe she was tired. That's a photo to me that you keep, you know, because it really shows that person in a real moment. But most of all, you just be a good person. You don't bother people. You respect their wishes. If they never see you take their picture, that's kind of the goal of street photography, to be completely candid, but you become their conscience for them, you know?
And you write in your online introduction to the digital book, quote, "I'm looking for the beautiful in the normal, the glory in the inglorious, and that one ray of sunlight kissing the side of your face as you, smiling, go about your day." That's a very sweet sentiment, especially in light of the obstacles you've been dealt. Does it come from a place of staying in the moment and recognizing our mortality?
It does. And it also comes from a place of recognizing that every single human being is special in some way or another. And when you are in my lens, you are the only other person on the planet to me in some ways. And whether I'm reading your facial expressions correctly or not, they usually give you away. They can tell if you're lost in thought, if you're having a happy moment, a sad moment. And those are the real moments. That's when you're real, you know, and that's what I want to capture, is the beauty of the real, the people in the moments when they're really who they are rather than someone who's posing.
And there's such an intimacy about that. What is it about Fresno that speaks to you as a photographer?
A couple of things. I work mostly downtown. There are a few photos in the book from farmers markets and the fair and stuff, but almost all of them are from downtown. Downtown is beautiful. I don't think a lot of people who live in Fresno and rarely go down there understand that if you stop and take the time to walk around and just look at the buildings, you know, that architecture is gorgeous. The facades are gorgeous. Some of it built in, you know, in the 1920s, you know, in particular styles. That if you just stop in front of the Security Bank building and just look at those columns, you know, or some of the other buildings and look up at the facades, you know, look up at the intricate work done. We don't do that kind of stuff anymore. And so Fresno has a really strong, beautiful history.
And I love the line that you have on your website that says, "Life is most beautiful when it does not know it is being watched." Is that sort of the essence of street photography?
Very much so, yeah.
Again, we've been listening to James Gathright. He's a designer, writer, and photographer, and he's produced a digital book of 100 photos called I was born in a small town, street photography in the shadow of cancer. Thank you so much, James.
Thank you.
You can find Gathright's photos of people and places in downtown Fresno online at imageandword.com.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Carrie Klein. And now for the weekend. The Real Pride Film Festival in Fresno is the sixth largest and the sixth longest running LGBTQ film festival in the country. Next week marks its 30th year. Reporter Monica Velez caught up with Kathleen Arambula Reyna, the director and board president of Real Pride, to find out how the festival has helped shape the cultural diversity of the city.
Kathleen Arambula Reyna says the festival brings films that most people don't have access to in the Central Valley.
Year 30 is extremely important because it shows a perseverance and persistence of our community. As recently as 2-3 years ago, we did not see LGBTQ themed films. Now that it's becoming popular, we are seeing them a little bit more in the movie houses, but not to the same degree that we would in a larger city. So Fresno Real Pride is extremely important in bringing that culture to this area.
She says there are a number of reasons why having an LGBTQ film festival in the Valley is important.
First and foremost, it's to expose issues that we deal with to the rest of the community, to show that we are just like them with similar problems, similar laughter, similar everything. There is nothing that is really different about us other than how we identify. Another reason why it's important to bring LGBTQ movies to the Central Valley is we want to make sure that the youth of our valley understand that there are people just like them, not only in their backyard holding this festival, but other youth that are having similar problems that they have literally from around the world. And it is not isolating. It's something that they are one of many.
That's why the festival has a Saturday Youth Night, where people can come watch films specific to LGBTQ youth for free.
And we need them to know that there's a place for them in the valley that is safe. And we need them to know that there are people in the valley that grew up just like them. And we need them to know that there are people from around the world that are experiencing the same things they are, and that they are part of a larger community.
Diana Oliva is one example. She grew up in Sanger and identifies as a transgender Chicana. She is starring in the first short film she's ever written, called Tacos y Tacones, and it's debuting at Real Pride. She says the film is a quick snapshot of three middle-aged transgender women. They're trying to survive in Hollywood as sex workers while also trying to find love and achieve their dreams.
It's a film about some of my experiences that I had back in 2001, 2002, when I was engaged in survival sex work in Hollywood on Santa Monica Boulevard, and some of the interactions that I had with some of my friends on the streets when we were trying to survive.
Oliva says she wanted to depict that trans people have the same dreams as other people, like finding love and wanting to be loved. Here's a clip from the film.
We drank wine and we talked all night, and he told me about how he's been single for a while now. He prefers trans women and he actually wants to settle down with one.
Oliva says she had to leave the valley to find people who looked and talked like her, but she hopes it's different for youth today.
So I think for trans youth, it gives them some inspiration and motivation that, wow, there's elders in our communities. I can make a difference. And look at them. They're on the screens. They're writing. They're directing. They're producing. They're acting. And that, you know, trans people are beautiful. Trans people are important. And trans people have a lot to contribute to society.
Oliva says she's also proud she can bring visibility to trans people of color. Tacos y Tacones will premiere at the Vista Theater in the Tower District on Sunday, September 22nd at 11 a.m.
The Real Pride Film Festival runs September 18th to the 22nd. We should note, Valley Public Radio is a sponsor of the event.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook.
Don't forget to check out our app. It's called KVPR, and it's available for free on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by the KVPR news team. Alice Daniel, Monica Velez,
Carrie Klein, and Laura Satsui. Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment, Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need. On the web at chcf.org.